Well, as Paul said, this is the first in a series on the temple through the Bible. We're chasing a temple through the Bible, hence the title Temple Run. Just give me a blank look if you've got no idea what Temple Run is. Okay, Temple Run is a game that you play on your phone or your iPad or whatever, if you've got a touchscreen phone, and that's the game that you play. I don't play it for very long, to be honest, because I die very quickly. So I but my kids play it for ages. And the points that we're going to cover, not the points like, from the game, but the areas that we're going to look at tonight. Like I said, there was a wealth of puns I could have had in there that I've totally missed. Kind of looking at how we define temple first off, like looking at what temple is, because the immediate thought for me is that there is no temple in Eden, obviously. I've read the creation account, I've read Genesis, I know there's no temple in Eden. So it's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about the temple in Eden. And then once we've looked at that, what we're really going to do is look at Eden as a sacred space, and then God's relationship plan for man, and then we're going to look at the temple challenge. So to begin with, defining the temple, I wouldn't worry about reading it all, but this is what Wikipedia says about the temple. And I suppose to begin with, its description kind of gets us thinking about an area that's constructed by man. So there are some points in this definition that I'm going to use, and there's some points in this definition that I'm not. It's only Wikipedia. It's not like not essential stuff. But the first thing that I'm talking about is that the temple's a sacred space. Okay, it's a sacred space. And the idea of the temple is it's a place where, for us, it's a place where God dwells. And for, other religions, they would say that their temple is the dwelling place for their God. The other thing with a temple is it's a place of relationship. It's a place of relationship with ourselves and God, with ourselves and other believers. And it's also a place of relationship with ourself, actually, a time for meditation, for thoughtfulness, and a time for getting our head straight and all that kind of stuff. And of course, it's a place of worship, but in Eden, it's not a place that's man-made. Now, man has had a go making sacred spaces, as you know, and even around 4,000 years ago, we were at it in the UK making sacred spaces, and here's what our ancestors came up with. It's a very good kind of sacred space, a place where loads of work went into this, apparently, and our ancestors, put these stones up, ended there, a dwelling place for the gods that they were worshipping. Well, God also did a little bit of creating himself. He created one of these, which kind of puts it in perspective, doesn't it? I mean, it's just, I haven't got all the stats and the numbers about how big the universe is, but we all know that it's huge. But what we're going to do is we're going to zoom in from the galaxy to the garden, if you like. So zooming right in from the galaxy right into the Garden of Eden, and in Genesis 2, verse 8-14, we're actually told where, like, the coordinates of this garden were. Now, admittedly, you wouldn't be able to send a postcard there, but it does tell us that it's a real place. It's a real geographic location where the garden was located. I like that kind of thing. I like the fact that we know it's not just an illustrative picture. It is a real place where two real people lived, where Adam and Eve actually lived. But a focus of this sermon is not the garden. The focus of the sermon is not Eden. And it's not the origin of the human race either. But the focus has got to be God. The focus has got to be the originator of creation, the mastermind behind it all. Now, I'm currently reading Does God Believe in Atheists? I'm reading it quite slowly because I'm in those first few chapters where it's very philosophical and it's a bit of pushing treacle uphill. But but your average atheist would kind of go with the argument that God's a notion, a fabrication, and actually that that each individual person, each individual human, is the only frame of reference for moral guidance. And they would go that the Earth exploded into the galaxy with a great big pop, and the opening chapters of Genesis just show us totally that that wasn't the case, that creation was masterminded, it was planned out, it wasn't careless, it wasn't casual, it was nothing accidental about it. And we'll see, as we canter through the sermon, that God alone gives us meaning and significance to everything that we do, whether or not we believe it. The atheist has none of that. There's no meaning to life at all without God. Now, when we see that sort of Eden brought into being, we'll see that it wasn't strictly for the habitation of humans. It wasn't just for humans to live in. They were there as stewards, and he invites them to enjoy and cultivate and expand the garden, in fact, to actually take the garden out further to the original boundaries. And if Adam and Eve had been effective in that role, then in fact the whole of the world would actually be a temple for God. The whole of the world would be a temple garden. And as we'll see, as the series continues, that the original perfect universe that God brought into existence in Genesis 1 serves as a prototype, a kind of temple template, if you like, for future temples, for the tabernacle, for the temple, and those other buildings. And the idea was that it's going to include a place where God's covenant people could come together and worship. But I'm not going to go on about that, because that'll make Jamie and the others in the series kind of nervous about me treading on their toes. But Eden, a sacred space. So let's think about Eden as a sacred space first off. I got a little bit stuck doing this, thinking about that that, you know, that philosophical question: does a tree make any noise if it falls over and nobody hears it? Is there a sound? And I was thinking, was it sacred in the Garden of Eden before man came along? Was it actually a sacred place when there was no man for it to be sacred for? I didn't get too sidetracked on it for long, because by verse 27. Fortunately, man comes along, and I didn't have to worry about it anymore, because actually it is a sacred place then, isn't it? And there is man. And the thing that I also thought about was the fact that, is there something conspicuous by its absence? Is there something that God kind of forgot to do, or forgot to instruct man to do? Did God forget to instruct man to build a temple? Well, no, that would be ridiculous. Of course he didn't. It's because the garden itself was the temple. It was a garden temple where man actually came and visited, where God actually came and visited man. He visited man in the cool of the afternoon. He actually spoke to man. He actually gave man instructions about what his expectation was, about his stewardship of the garden, and also about what he could eat and about naming animals and all those things. That's something that God did. He met with man and did that. It was like a link between the heavens and the earth. This was a place where God visited man. And you might kind of ask me, well, we know that God is holy and he's all present and all knowing, and that we need to speak to God with respect. And when we look at the ways that the Israelites had to go to the had to meet with God, kind of look at that relationship and go, it was tough. It wasn't possible for people to actually go and meet with God in that way. You had the Holy of Holies. You had one priest who could go and meet with them and sort of meet with God, but not just any time. And we know that we can meet with God any time for one reason only. The only reason that we can talk directly to God is because he sent his son to die for us. So there's a huge cost that was paid for that privilege. But in the garden, it seems as though God just goes and talks to Adam and Eve. Well, I guess the point we have to understand here is that when Eden was made and Adam and Eve were made, it was all perfect. There was nothing wrong there. There was no sin. There was nothing that tarnished anything. So God could have that relationship if he chose to with man. And he did. And I should add here that when I talk about man and when I talk about Adam, I mean, Adam and Eve here are, although we talk about individuals, we are actually talking about representations of mankind, of humanity. And Eden is, of course, the starting point for God's relationship with humanity. Now, I first read this, that comment about Eden being a starting point for God's relationship with humanity in this kind of quite academic paper. And I think, you know, that is really obvious, isn't it? I mean, there wasn't any man before that. It had to be the starting point. It kind of surprises me sometimes that people write these things down. But then I started thinking about it and thinking about the relationship between kind of Adam and man. And I suppose I was thinking about the relationship that you have with your kids. Because your relationship with your kids begins on their birthday. Not on their birthday when you give them presents, but on their day of their birth. That's when the relationship begins. But see, it's not much of a relationship then. It's more of a bond. It's more of just a one-way bond, really. And it's it's quite amazing, this new bundle of cells that's kind of shuffled onto this mortal coil, if you like. That you've got this bond with it. They haven't done anything. They haven't brought anything to the party. That's it. That's why you want to have the relationship. And it was exactly the same for Adam. See, when God created him, Adam was a thinking, breathing person. He was ready for a relationship. But he didn't have anything that he brought. He didn't have any funny stories. He didn't have any. He didn't have anything that was with him. I mean, he'd come to the party without a bottle, and in fact, he didn't even have an overcoat, did he? But it just didn't matter. It just didn't matter. And in the same way, with that newborn baby born to loving parents, they're born without anything to bring to the party except for potential. So the same for Adam, made entirely by God. With empty hands, but born into a perfect place, a sacred space, the perfect Garden of Eden. So, at this point in the narrative, what we have is a garden formed and the garden filled. And the work has begun to be undertaken. And all that is from God. And it's all very good. God tells us that it's all very good. Then gets even better, because in Genesis 2:22, God creates a naked woman. So it really does get a whole lot better for Adam. Now, the thing about that is that there was no guilt or shame, because it was a perfect relationship. It was a place where there was no sin, no shame, no guilt. And the thing that makes this whole business so truly amazing is actually when we stop and take a step back and just remember how awesome our God is. You see, the credentials of our Creator King are massive. Isaiah 66 verse 1 says, "Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool." Isaiah 40:22, "He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in." And in verse 26, "Lift your eyes up to the heavens. Who created all these? Who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name? Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing." And then in the Psalms, "The Lord is exalted over all the nations, his glory above the heavens. Who is like the Lord, our God? The one who sits enthroned on high, who stoops down to look on the heavens and the earth." See, you get this picture of our mighty God outside the confines of space, outside the confines of time, and he stoops down and he looks at the earth. And in fact, he even looks down on the heavens. Psalm 102 reminds us that in the beginning, God laid all the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of his hands. The Creator laid the foundations of the earth, as well as the vast stretches of the universe. He is so powerful that, metaphorically speaking, he dresses himself in a robe made out of light and he stretches out the heavens like a tent curtain. He uses the clouds as a chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. And moreover, the Lord of all creation placed the earth firmly on its foundations, ensuring that it will never be upended. This is the God that created us, and this is a God that invites us into relationship with him. It's quite amazing. Back to the narrative, though. The seventh day, God rests. So God's created man, and on the seventh day, God rests. And when God rests, he's not depicted as a mighty warrior or a conqueror or anything like that, but he's more of an artist. I like to kind of think of God here as, it's the way that old Tom Wright describes him. It's a creative master chef almost that has just cooked this tremendous banquet, this multi-course banquet, and then he kind of kisses his fingers with the perfection that he's created. And he's got this perfection and he's got this relationship planned. So what's happened so far is the earth has been formed and the earth has been filled. It's formed, it's got light and dark. And day two, the sky and the sea. And day three, the fertile earth. And then the earth is filled on day four. The lights of the day and the night. The birds and the fish. The land animals, including man. And then in Genesis 1:28, God speaks to Adam. And he says to Adam, like God has this conversation with Adam. He actually speaks to him. And God blessed them and he said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." And God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit and seed in it, and they will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds and the air and the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And so it was. See, man has his instruction given to God personally. He was also granted dominion, authority over animals, and is given every plant for food. And the question is, why? Why did God bestow that kind of responsibility on man? So I suppose, first of all, we should remember God's decision to bring humankind into existence in the first place. You see, it was his final act. It was like this, the cherry on the cake, this is. This is the perfect finale. You see, although it was the pinnacle of creation, we have to remember that humankind still remains utterly dependent on what God's provided. And also utterly accountable for him for their actions, and that's something that becomes abundantly clear at the fall. But before we get there, we have to remember that we're created in God's image, and we know, of course, that we're not referencing God's physical image here. So what is the image that we're created in? What is the image that man and woman are created in? Well, that's a big discussion point. And what I'm going to go for here in terms of the image that we have, that we're created in returns of God, is our ability to make ethical decisions, our kind of our high mental powers compared to other animals in creation, and even with fallen humanity, even with the fact that that image is broken, it still can be seen. People are still special. People still bear that divine likeness of God. Now, that rulership over earth, that rulership of what we're supposed to, of what Adam and Eve were supposed to do in terms of looking after the earth, in terms of being stewards, is a kind of a reflection of what God does, is what God does for us. So what I mean by that, I suppose, is that by ruling over the rest of creation in a responsible fashion, we bear witness to the divine likeness placed within humanity. Now, up until this point, there was a perfect relationship. When God gives this instruction, there's a perfect relationship in place. There's this kind of perfect peace, this kind of idea of shalom, this idea that there's a perfect relationship between man and with God, between man and with Eve and with creation, and also between man and himself, between man and his own mind. They felt no shame and no guilt, guilt-free, perfect, with no sin. Then in Genesis 2:15, God actually takes Adam, it says, and takes him to the sacred place, takes him to the garden. And here we have the first instance after man is made where God gives him that firm instruction. He puts him in the garden and God gives him the instruction to look after it. And this is a kind of priestly role for Adam. And the idea is that some of the terminology that is used here is the same as is used later on. See, the underlying Hebrew verbs, which I'm not even going to try and pronounce because I won't get them right, but they're rendered kind of serving and worshipping or guarding and protecting, and there are corresponding passages of scripture that also link in with this. It's also referred to as duties of the priests performing their duties in the sanctuary, keeping it undefiled from profane objects. So the idea is that there's this link between the priests in the Old Testament and Adam and Eve in the garden there. And the logical inference there, the logical conclusion to kind of to draw there, is that the Creator, God, originally wanted Adam and Eve to perform those priestly duties in the Garden of Eden, including the cultivation and upkeep of that sacred space. Then God reiterates the instruction that he gave to Adam in Genesis 1:29, saying that you can eat from any of the seed-bearing plants. He says you can eat from any tree in the garden, except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And this is all personal interaction. This is all relationship stuff. This is all God having a conversation with man. And then later on in verse 19, I love this image. And Dave this morning was talking about the deacons and the deacons working together and kind of building the Marley building or digging out whatever it was and saying it was a great time of fellowship. And I kind of have this image, and I don't know how it was, but when you read chapter 2, verse 19, you've got the image. So the Lord's formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air, and he brings them to Adam to name them. Now that sounds to me like something that's done in cooperation with someone else. It's like working together. That's one person, or what, you know, so God's kind of saying, here are the animals, I want you to name them. That's kind of working together to do something. It's a great way to form a bond, to form a relationship. But the thing is that Adam and Eve didn't succeed in their priestly duties. They failed in that role they were given. They failed when they were when they succumbed to the temptation of the serpent. And the thing was is that just wrecked everything. That wrecked that relationship that had been there. And it's of course just after that event, just after Adam and Eve have succumbed to the influence of the serpent that we read about the Lord coming to walk in the gardens in the cool of the day. And this is so sad. This is so sad that Adam and Eve are hiding. So the God that Adam was working with, the God that he was in conversation with, the Creator God that made the whole universe, that wanted a relationship with man and woman, are now hiding in the bushes like a couple of scared school kids, really. I mean, it's just the saddest thing. And I think that's one of the reasons why I found this this sermon so difficult to, this passage so hard to really get my head round. This kind of, what's happened here is we've gone from the earth being formed to it being filled to the fall. So God has set it all up. The whole earth was set up for a relationship with him. It's all about God's grace. It's all about things that God did that he didn't have to do. He's made us to enjoy a relationship with God, to enjoy a relationship with each other, and through nature, through worship, through work. And that relationship was so important that even after man had busted it, he still sent his one and only son to come and fix it, to die for us, so that we would not perish, we could have eternal life. And the reason that I found it so challenging was partly because I'd never thought about the temple in Eden, and there's a lot of academic stuff written about this, and it was hard to get the base knowledge to a place where you go, you know, how is this applicable? What does this really mean? What is it? Why is that important? Even if you go, well, the temple was there in Eden, why is that important? And then as I started to realise it was about relationship, as I started to realise it's all about our relationship with God and our relationship with other people, that became incredibly challenging to me. You see, it's time for us to examine our relationships with God and with other people. You see, Jesus, when he's asked what the most important commandment is, he quotes from Deuteronomy. So the story about this is in Mark 12, and it's verse 30 and 31. But he's asked what the most important commandment is. And Jesus says, it's to love the Lord your God with everything, with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength. And that's how we need to aim for our relationship with God to be. And I think that when I look at my life, I'm really, really very challenged about that. And then when I look at the second part of Jesus' answer there, Mark 12, 31, he says, the second most important commandment is to love your neighbour as you love yourself. Now, the temple challenge that I found was that in Eden, God had fixed it up to be in order for mankind to have a relationship with him. But we, in the shape of Adam and Eve, turned away. God's restored that busted bond through Jesus, but are we really seeking to have that relationship with God in everything? Are we really loving our neighbour as we love ourselves? We know what relationship is. We know that we can have this relationship with God through Jesus. But the question is, are we? Are we really doing that? And that's been my personal challenge. That's what really challenged me about this is, am I doing that? Am I really loving God with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my strength? And do I really love my neighbour? Do I really love my fellow Christian brother and sister as I love myself? So they are very challenging words from a God who created a temple garden for a relationship with him. That promise of relationship in the temple garden runs throughout history and beyond, in fact, into all eternity. The question is, are we really ready and are we really responding as we ought to? So on that note, we will consider that as we sing our final hymn, which is, To You, O Lord, Will All the Earth